And because all worshipping are, as we call it in technical term, tawqifi actions, it means that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala himself should specify that action, how to be practiced and how to be performed.
Yeah.
And because of that, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has mentioned, and of course we have many narrations from the noble prophet and from his pure progeny, and they describe for us the way how to go to Mecca and how to do this pilgrimage. So if we want to obey him and to practice this worship, we have to do it in that designed way. Because of that, actually, as I explained, this is the manifestation of unity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your enlightening answers to the questions, and your respected listeners for staying tuned and listening to Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRB English Radio. And I hope that you like this show and you will join us again, inshallah, in our upcoming sessions. Till then, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Communicate.
The English High Court has decided that Julian Assange can be extradited to the United States. The High Court overturned a lower court's decision from January, which blocked the extradition of the Australian journalist and WikiLeaks founder. Assange faces up to 175 years in US prison for publishing diplomatic cables and classified documents, which show war crimes committed by the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan. The High Court said that it trusts the assurances provided by the US not to put Assange in oppressive prison conditions and to let him serve a potential sentence in Australia. A few weeks ago on this program, we debunked these assurances. I published classified documents from the case of David Mendoza, who was also extradited to the United States and given almost identical assurances that he could serve his sentence back home. These documents unquestionably prove how the United States violated its diplomatic assurances. In its ruling, the High Court said that it examined Mendoza's case, among others, and found no wrongdoing on the part of the Americans, and nothing to suggest that the United States had violated its diplomatic assurances in the past, or that it would do the same with Assange. With all due respect, the High Court could not be more wrong. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Before I explain the High Court's judgment, here's a brief recap to remind you where we are exactly in the Assange case. In January 2021, District Judge Vanessa Bretzer blocked Assange's extradition to the U.S. on health grounds. She found U.S. prisons to be too oppressive and that the conditions of Assange's confinement would lead him to commit suicide. A few months later, in October, the United States went to the English High Court and appealed against this decision on five grounds. Then, on the morning of December 10th, the High Court issued its judgment. I was there in remote attendance at the High Court, and I reported live as Lord Justice Timothy Holroyd read out the decision allowing the extradition of the WikiLeaks founder to go ahead. In its ruling, the High Court denied the U.S. appeal on three out of five grounds, These were grounds 1, 3, and 4. In essence, the High Court accepted that Assange suffered from a precarious mental condition. It accepted that the district judge applied the test correctly under Section 91 of the Extradition Act when she found his extradition to be oppressive. At the same time, the High Court did allow the U.S. appeal to go ahead on grounds 2 and 5. The High Court accepted the diplomatic assurances given by the United States and agreed that the district judge, quote, ought to have notified the USA of her provisional view to afford it the opportunity of offering assurances to the court. As we've highlighted before, these diplomatic assurances provided by the U.S. pose several problems. Just by reading them, you can immediately see that the United States has given itself a way out to avoid abiding by its promises. For example, the first assurance says, quote, the United States will not impose special administrative measures, SAMs, on Mr. Assange pre-trial or post-conviction. However, in the same sentence, it says the United States still reserves the right to impose SAMs if Assange were to, quote, commit any future act that met the test for the imposition of a SAM. So what does that mean exactly? What would meet the test for an imposition of a SAM? This is very ambiguous and unclear. The United States could frankly find any reason to say that Assange is threatening national security or some other excuse and then throw him in SAMs to spite him.
You're on your phone call, like I was with a family relative, my mom. And I say to my mom on that phone call from prison, you know, tell my buddy that he needs to go see my attorney. Well, that in itself, the prison monitoring system kicks it back to security, their high level of review. And that, just that simple comment, would put him in a facility, probably ADX.
The United States also has things like Communications Management Units, CMU, or Special Housing Units, SHU, where it can lock prisoners up in isolation. The United States could easily place Assange in either of those and then say, we didn't break any assurances, we only said we wouldn't put him in SAMs. Yes, but the whole reason Assange's extradition was blocked in the first place is because of the isolation, the solitary confinement, the prison conditions that would make him take his own life, not to mention the extradition itself. So whether you put him in a CMU or SHU or SAMS, it's all the same and could still lead him to take his own life. Now, the second assurance provided by the United States is that, quote, if Mr. Assange is convicted in the U.S., he will be eligible, following conviction, sentencing, and conclusion of any appeals, to apply for a prisoner transfer to Australia to serve his U.S. sentence. As the lead U.S. prosecutor James Lewis put it, Assange can now look forward to going to jail in his home country, Australia. Now, here's the problem with this assurance. The United States cannot just snap its fingers and say, fine, you can go to Australia. Both the U.S. and Australia have to agree first. Now, under Article 3 of the Convention on the Transfer of Sentenced Persons, it clearly says that, quote, a sentenced person may be transferred under this convention only on the following conditions. F, if the sentencing and administering states agree to the transfer. I can personally confirm that so far Australia has said nothing about taking Assange. And the High Court judges know this. They even say it in the judgment. They say that despite Australia giving no indication, this cannot be attributed as a fault or criticism of the United States. Now, if Assange is extradited, he will be tried at the U.S. District Court of the Eastern District of Virginia, commonly known as the Espionage Court, because it regularly uses the Espionage Act of 1917 against journalists and whistleblowers. Chelsea Manning, who gave classified documents to Assange, was tried here. The indictment against NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden and Julian Assange were also unsealed here. Another person who was tried at this court under the Espionage Act is Jeffrey Sterling, who used to work for the CIA. In 2010, Sterling was accused of leaking classified information to a reporter about a CIA operation to sabotage Iran's nuclear program called Operation Merlin. He was charged under the Espionage Act and threatened with hundreds of years in prison, drawing comparisons to Assange. In 2015, Sterling was sentenced to 3.5 years imprisonment. This whole debacle came several years after he had been fired from the CIA when he tried taking them to court over racist treatment that he had been subjected to while working at the agency. Given his background in U.S. intelligence and being a former CIA man himself, I asked Sterling how likely he thinks it is that the United States could go through back channels and tell Australia, another Five Eyes country, not to take its own citizen, Julian Assange, to serve any potential sentence down under. You being having a background in the intelligence community. Again, this is just speculation, but how likely is it that the United States has gone through back channels and told Australia not to take Assange? Because we know very well under Article 3F of the Strasbourg Treaty, both countries need to agree to the prison transfer. It can't be just the U.S. saying yes and then he's magically taken to Australia. Australia needs to say yes too. How likely is it that the U.S. can go to back channels and just tell the Australians not to take him?
I think it's very likely, if not, if it hasn't happened already. With individuals, the main thing with, related to this, the main thing with Assange is that the U.S. has engaged in character assassination for years upon years against Assange, characterizing him essentially as a terrorist and a danger to the national interest of this country. With that as the backdrop, the U.S. can refuse to provide any information with regard to Assange to any other country, particularly Australia, if they want to hold him. The U.S. can hold him indefinitely at the U.S.'s leisure and in whatever facility they would like to hold him. I was in a low security facility. I technically wasn't under the special administrative SAMS program or monitoring my communications, but again, I was never told that I was. I think the question is open whether I was or not. I certainly got a lot of responses from individuals about letters that I would receive, questions about certain phone calls, things like that. I wasn't limited in who I could email, yet it just felt like I was being monitored. One example, and I think this set off many alarm bells for the prison, if not the Bureau of Prisons. My wife sent me some Farsi language books so I could at least just try to maintain my language ability. She did that. I had no idea. It was only months later when they provided me the books. And I said, well, what? And I asked, what was the holdup? And they were just, they said, well, we've never seen that language before. And I know what they were saying. It looks like Arabic, and am I a terrorist sort of thing. And again, that is related to how the Department of Justice characterized me, and throw in the national security aspect. And that is certainly what is going to be the case with Assange. He is going to be in the most secure facility that they can find. The Bureau of Prisons can act in whatever way it wants. However, it will take guidance from the intelligence community with regard to how Assange will be held.
Even if Australia gives prior consent and agrees to the transfer in advance, under the Prisoner Transfer Treaty, you could only request the transfer once your sentence has been finalized. That means if Assange is taken to the U.S. and he loses in court and they give him a lengthy sentence, which is practically guaranteed, what's the first thing Assange is going to do? He's going to appeal it. So he'll go first to the appellate court in that particular district, a process that can take around 4 years alone. Assange will eventually lose there as well, and then he'll ask to take his case to the Supreme Court. That could also take another 3 to 4 years, and that's if they even hear his case at all. Mendoza thinks that's highly unlikely.
I know what they're playing there too. They're going to give him a long sentence, and then they're going to say, well, because you can't get transferred until your sentence is finalized. So they're going to tell him, if you want to get transferred, you got to accept the sentence. You can't appeal it to the Supreme Court. And that's a game that they're going to play. They're going to write him out for another 10 or 15 years until that gets decided in the Supreme Court, if it does get decided in the Supreme Court, because many times the Supreme Court won't take the case. It'll sit there and dock it for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And then they just send you back a note later and say, well, we've decided not to accept this case.
In Mendoza's case, Mendoza wasn't just given a diplomatic assurance that he could serve his sentence back home, like they're telling Assange. Mendoza even signed a contract with the United States and Spain that he would be sent back to Spain to serve his sentence. A contract is a legally binding document, and the United States broke it anyway. So what chance does Assange or anyone else stand? Now, another assurance given by the Americans is that once Assange is in U.S. custody, he would be given medical treatment to help with any physical and psychological ailments. The U.S. says it will ensure that Mr. Assange will receive any such clinical and psychological treatment, quote, as is recommended by a qualified treating clinician employed or retained by the prison where he is held in custody. Once again, you can see how ambiguous this is, because it doesn't actually guarantee Assange any medical care. It only says he'll get medical care if the prison physician agrees to it. Jeffrey Sterling was suffering a heart condition while in prison. When he asked the prison doctors for medical attention because of chest pains and shortness of breath, his calls for help fell on deaf ears. It took scores of people, including a U.S. senator, pleading on his behalf before he was finally given any medical attention.
When I was in prison, I developed heart issues. I had had previous issues with my heart. One day I felt like I was having a heart attack. I remember going to the medical staff, and they were completely blowing me off. I mean, their answer to me having chest pains and shortness of breath and breaking out in a sweat was to drink more water. I let my wife know what was going on, because where else was I to turn? And she rallied thousands of people to bombard the prison with emails, phone calls. And eventually, a U.S. senator reached out to the prison and asked what was going on with regard to my health and whether I was receiving health care or not. Only through that effort, that incredible effort, was I able to get the health care that I needed. Had I not, and in prison, there were many times where you could see, and you know, I've seen individuals who were dead, inmates who died because they did not receive proper medical attention. I was certainly fearful that I was going to be another of that number. And it took that incredible effort, spearheaded by my wife and my supporters throughout the world, for me to get just basic medical attention. And that is so typical of the U.S. prison system. The best way to describe U.S. prisons are they're just human warehouses, places to put bodies, categorize them, file them away, and forget about them. And any interaction is, again, perpetual punishment. So they will go out of their way, the staff, they'll go out of their way to abuse, neglect your needs, and really make life miserable. It's miserable enough being in prison, but they go out of their way to emphasize all of that to any inmate.
Speaking of medical assistance in prison, in the U.S. prison system, you know, I've been covering Julian Assange's case, and one of the assurances the United States government has given him is that once in U.S. custody, he'll receive medical attention under the recommendation of the prison physician, whatever that means. And there's one tweet that you wrote that says, quote, "I can guarantee that in a U.S. prison, he, meaning Assange, would not receive medical attention. It took the attention of a U.S. senator for me to receive proper medical attention," as you just recalled. Could you expand on that for us, you know, given your own experience, what you've seen there, what it would be like for Julian Assange, what it is like for others who are in the U.S. prison system?
Again, healthcare is an afterthought in U.S. prisons. They will go out of their way to make sure they're not providing any care for you. For anyone, any medical issues, the first position that is taken is that the individual, and also in my case, that the individual is faking, that just want attention or the opportunity to get outside the walls to go to a doctor. So there's the first step is to blame the inmate for the condition. The next step is to do nothing. And then the third, when people started reaching out early on, in my case, the most effort that they will put in is defending their position and calling everyone else a liar, or again, relying on, well, this it's not as serious as the person is taking it, all the while shielding themselves behind those walls, the prison walls, to not provide the care that they are supposed to provide. And I think that is across the board. That was in a U.S. prison. When I was first arrested, I was at the Alexandria Detention Center. I received no medical care there either. I had just come off a month of, I was still rehabilitating from knee replacement surgery. It was quite a serious involved surgery. They provided absolutely no medical care for me there. In fact, they were giving me quote, painkillers that were contraindicated to the blood thinners that I was on. You make complaints about this, and it goes absolutely nowhere. I mean, if there is a home of bureaucracy, it is the Bureau of Prisons or any jail system.
Sterling also told me about the psychological torment that he was subjected to while in prison. He was neglected and threatened by the prison medical staff with solitary confinement if he didn't cut it out with feeling depressed.
Speaking of health, the other aspect is mental health. There will be absolutely no attention or any sort of assistance with mental health. When I was in prison throughout that ordeal that lasted for so many years, I was certainly suicidal at times. I was very down. My feeling was that my country has thrown me out. My country didn't want me. My country didn't believe me. So I was certainly mentally in a very bad state. I was called before the prison psychologist and threatened with being thrown in solitary if I didn't essentially cut it out. If I didn't stop being depressed, I was going to be put in solitary, which would, of course, make the situation even worse. But that is typical of the type of, and I use the term loosely, care that anyone in the prison system will receive. I don't even think there's a question of that. And the so-called assurances that the U.S. authorities have given to the U.K. courts aren't worth the paper that they're written on. It has really shocked me how the case, you know, throughout the entire proceeding has really been based on untruths, if not lies, about what Julian is going to be facing. One is that he would not receive 175 years. And they had the audacity early in the proceedings to highlight my case as a benchmark for the type of sentence anyone going up against the Espionage Act would receive. I was facing over 100 years. When the judge gave me 42 months, the prosecutor was absolutely livid. He was wanting far more than that. And that is exactly what Assange is going to face. Any assurances about not receiving a harsh sentence are incredible. I mean, it's just incredible that they would even make such a claim.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time. Just really appreciate you coming on, sharing your experiences with us, and your invaluable insight and knowledge. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I recently published classified documents of the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Spanish courts about the extradition of David Mendoza Herarte. He was also given similar assurances to those of Assange. In fact, he even signed a contract, as we just mentioned before. Assange's lawyers cited Mendoza's case during the High Court hearings in October. In the High Court judgment, the judges say they examined Mendoza's and Abu Hamza's cases and found that, quote, neither provides any evidence of a failure to comply with an assurance, and neither provides any support for Mr. Assange's submission that this court should not regard the offered assurances as reliable. If you look carefully, just before that, they state that, quote, both can be said to show that the USA may be expected to apply the strict letter of an assurance which it has given. They're basically admitting that US assurances are so vague the US can get around them without really breaking them, and that is the whole problem. Now, when I read this, I'm frankly astounded. It sounds to me like the judges only read the verbal note, the diplomatic note, sent by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid in January 2009. But that is just one assurance in Mendoza's case. Now, diplomatic assurances can come in many forms, and Mendoza did receive another. He had a contract called the Acta de Entrega, or Deed of Surrender. This contract, this diplomatic assurance, was signed by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, by the Spanish government, and Mendoza himself. And it clearly stipulates that Mendoza must be sent back to Spain to serve his sentence. He cannot be given a life sentence, and so on. Did the High Court judges in England see this contract at all? Because if the initial verbal note was vague, well, this document certainly isn't. The Acta de Entrega is a very crystal clear contract and a diplomatic assurance that the United States violated without a doubt. They blocked Mendoza's transfer to Spain 3 times and kept him in the U.S. for almost 7 years. This is all in the documents that I published. Now, I can tell you that these documents were never shown or cited in any of the Assange court proceedings as of yet, which makes me wonder, did the judges even get a chance to examine them at all? How can they arrive to such a conclusion after looking at Mendoza's case? Because if they're missing all these documents, it's simply impossible to understand what happened. The High Court's decision to allow Assange's extradition to the United States is extremely disturbing on several fronts. Instead of pointing this out, instead of pointing out that this indictment criminalizes national security journalism, the corporate media, the mainstream media, are just joking around and gloating at the prospect of someone going to prison for the rest of their lives. For what? For doing their job as a journalist, which is something the people at MSNBC and CNN and the BBC know nothing about. Now, the High Court accepted that Assange is suicidal, that the extradition would be oppressive, but they also decided to trust the United States. They trust the U.S. to treat him well. And I must say, I'm shocked at this ruling. I don't understand how they could come to such a conclusion, especially after they say they looked at other extraditions like Mendoza's. Now, Assange's legal team have 14 days from the decision to request an appeal at the Supreme Court. Stella Morris, who is Assange's partner and also on the legal team, has confirmed that they will be doing this. When Assange is in court, they're not discussing press freedoms anymore. They've already criminalized that. And right now, they're discussing how he's going to be treated in U.S. custody and whether he'll kill himself because of how bad the prison conditions are. They're discussing whether these diplomatic assurances can be trusted. The answer is no. And that's what people must fight to highlight right now. That's why right now Mendoza's case is more important than ever, because it exposes how the United States and its promises cannot be trusted. I can tell you, the documents that I published were never mentioned as of yet in the courtroom during Assange's extradition proceedings. So whether the High Court judges have actually seen these documents, I don't know. But if they did see these documents, if they did see how the U.S. broke its assurances every single day for almost 7 years when it kept Mendoza in the U.S. and denied his transfer application 3 times, then I simply don't understand how they came to the conclusion that they can trust assurances for Assange, because they are terribly, terribly mistaken, and time is running out. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The EU's hypocrisy seems boundless. The European Union funds research involving Israeli regime's police, despite admitting that it may be used for spying purposes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by David Cronin, writer. This article is titled, EU admits teaming up with Israeli regime police enables mass surveillance. Stay tuned for more. The European Union funds research involving Israeli regime's police, despite admitting that it may be used for spying purposes. Over the past few years, a project named Roxanne has been examining how criminals can be identified with the aid of a speech recognition technology and visual analysis. Material intended for public consumption presents the EU finance project costing $8 million as benign. However, serious ethical issues have been raised when it was discussed behind closed doors. Internal EU documents obtained under Freedom of Information rules confirm there is a risk that Roxanne's results will be used for mass surveillance. An ethics check on the project conducted during 2020 refers to plans that personal data will be shared between the EU and the Zionist regime. The data collected during the project will incorporate special categories such as details on the genetic traits, health, lifestyle, political opinion, religious or philosophical conviction of individuals, according to that paper. The surrounding questions have become even more pertinent since the ethics check was carried out. Painstaking investigations by human rights groups proved last year that the Zionist regime's Pegasus spyware is being used more widely than was previously known to monitor campaigners and journalists in various countries. The Zionist regime's police and its public security ministry are among the participants in Roxanne. A condition of their involvement is that all data they export to the EU should be collected lawfully. Providing assurances of legal behavior is apparently deemed sufficient for the purposes of EU ethics checks to demonstrate that privacy issues are being treated seriously. In the real world, an Israeli assurance is completely worthless. The Zionist regime's police are seeking new powers that would allow greater surveillance without requiring warrants. A key proposal is that cameras in public places could be used to match people's faces with details found on police databases. Such a recommendation should, in itself, disqualify the Zionist regime's police from Roxanne, which pays lip service to the principle of privacy awareness. There are, of course, numerous other reasons why the Zionist regime's police should not be benefiting from EU science grants. One major reason is that the Zionist regime's police are institutionally racist. A recent Human Rights Watch report on Lid, a city within the occupied Palestinian territories, also known as Lod, contains a vivid example of police racism. The report describes how police fired tear gas and stun grenades at a protest by Palestinian citizens of occupied territories in Lid last May. Yet, in some cases, when Jewish extremists attacked Palestinians in the same city that month, the police either stood by or failed to protect Palestinians from harm. The Zionist regime's police and public security ministry both have their headquarters in East Al-Quds, which has been under military occupation since 1967. Doing business with them should, by definition, be off-limits for the European Union, which is nominally committed to avoiding action that would lend the capture and colonization of East Al-Quds any legitimacy. There are strong indications that the Zionist regime has not been entirely candid with administrators in Brussels. Documents for Roxanne Project give an address inside the occupied territories as the official contact for the public security ministry. If Brussels officials consulted the ministry's website, they would learn that its main offices can be actually found on Clermont's Gano Street in East Al-Quds. The involvement of the Zionist regime's police and public security ministry in Roxanne and another EU-funded project called Law Train has sparked protests from the Palestine Solidarity Movement. More protest is needed. The Zionist regime's police and its public security ministry have been admitted into at least 8 other projects under Horizon 2020, the EU's current research fund. Among them are 2 border surveillance initiatives, Andromeda and Safe Shore. As border surveillance has become synonymous with cruelty toward refugees, questions must be asked about the precise role being played by the Zionist regime's racist police. A particularly troubling aspect of all this cooperation is that boasts made by the Zionist regime police are seemingly taken at face value. An EU-funded project called Shuttle is building a database of blood, gunshot residues, hair, and saliva. The Zionist regime's police force is taking part and will contribute its experience as a forensic expert and technological leader, according to Shuttle website. There is no acknowledgement that the Zionist regime is actually an expert in operation. By awarding research grants to the Zionist regime police, the EU is rewarding a force that detains Palestinian children, terrifies entire families by invading their homes, and opens fire on worshippers in Al-Quds Al-Aqsa Mosque. The EU's hypocrisy seems boundless. Shortly before Hisham Abu Hawash ended his hunger strike earlier this week, EU diplomats proclaimed themselves seriously concerned about his health. The diplomats were not concerned enough to demand that the EU stop cooperating with the Zionist regime's public security ministry, the regime's department overseeing the prisons where Abu Hawash and many other Palestinians are locked up without charge or trial. In December, an agreement was signed so that the Zionist regime can benefit from the EU's next research fund. Named Horizon Europe, the fund has an overall budget of approximately $110 billion. Predictably, the EU promoted the new agreement by celebrating how its cooperation with the Zionist regime has supposedly brought great advancements in medicine and environmental protection. Just as predictably, there was no mention that the cooperation is a cash cow for the Zionist regime's racist police.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing In this program we discuss problems, issues and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are mostly based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and naturally of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and Islamic researcher Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, we'll be continuing our discussion on how to raise teenagers in an Islamic fashion. We said last time that we should know when we want to teach them something, educate them, or maybe even discipline them, that we should do so in a spontaneous manner. It should not be too overly scripted so as to bore them, but should be done in a natural and conversational manner. In addition to that, we also said that when speaking to them, we should employ pathos and logos, both emotion and logic, because only through a mix of both can we actually reach and get our point across to our teenage children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan al-la'in ar-rajim, bismillah ar-rahman ar-rahim, Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammadin wa ajjal farajah. Because we said it is a sensitive time for children crossing into teenage years. So as parents, the way we approach our kids, the way we speak to our kids, the way that we deal with our kids obviously has to change as well.
Right.
As far as they're going through a phase of change, they themselves, me and you, we have to go through that phase with them as well.
Right.
One of the things that most parents don't seem to do is to educate their kids about that period itself, being an adult or hitting puberty.
Right.
Where the child, as he turns into a mature, Islamically mature, reaches the age of maturity, he can see changes in his body, he can see changes in his behavior, he can see changes in his mentality, in his emotions towards things around him.
Right.
And 99% of the times he has no idea what's happening, right? So he's just an explorer.
And an explorer trying to blend in, I might add.
Well, not blend in, but he's trying to pretty much find out what's going on, where am I? He's like Indiana Jones in the middle of a pyramid.
So I don't know, I'm just confused a lot. I was trying to go with the flow.
Yeah, so he's in a maze, right? And a lot of parents, sadly, they don't explain that period to their kids. Obviously, I don't know, either out of fear, out of embarrassment,
or neglect, actually.
Out of ignorance. I don't know. How neglect, like you said. I mean, neglect is ignorance.
Because they're grown up, they're adults now. They should know a lot of things suddenly.
Yeah, so in a way or another, it is quite sad to see that happen. So first and foremost, we need to educate them about this period.
And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to raise our teenagers in an Islamic fashion. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
We are at a stage where we said we need to explain to our kids the period they are in. And in this period that the kids go in, especially through puberty, they need to understand their halal and their haram.
Of course.
Which is also a sensitive issue. Most kids go through a lot of emotional problems and emotional issues or things they bury inside, and they don't expect the parents to understand.
Of course.
Okay? And they have needs that needs to be explained to them as well. They need to be put in the direction.
Right.
Amongst of which their sexuality, which goes haywire at this age.
It is absolutely a monster. You cannot even tame it. Some say you can tame it, but...
So Islam, obviously Islam has a solution for it.
Right, yeah.
But the idea is that the parents need to put the child in the right mindset. Most people, for example, who grow old without being married or not wanting to get married is because at this age, they were not taught the proper ideology and the proper...
The way to approach this matter as well.
Yeah, so what they learn is they learn what they see on TV, what they see on the media. That
from the culture they live in.
Just have a girlfriend, for example, or a boyfriend, and that's it. Why get married?
It's very normal to have this thought. Very, very normal. Yeah, it's very prevalent among teenagers.
Exactly. So unless we sit them down,
we
explain to them how this period works and how to navigate it and how to get through it and how to manage it and give them that guidance ourselves, it will be, you know, a problem because they will be rebellious. They will be constantly arguing. They would never do what you want them to do. And, you know, they will be, you know, wasting time most of the time and they have nothing else to do. So I've heard so many complaints from parents about their kids. And when I ask them the basic questions about whether they have any sort of interaction or they explain things to them, they're like, no, we haven't. And then they're like, okay, then you should come and talk to them. I'm like, no, I can help from here and there.
But I can guide.
But ultimately, it's your job as a parent to explain this to your kids because... You know, he takes you as an authority, not me.
Right, yeah.
So, for example, if I had to talk to him about marriage, I mean, at the end of the day, I might convince him that marriage for him at a younger age is an excellent thing for him to do, which I always do with teenagers. I convince them that marriage is the best thing, and they're like, that's exactly what I was thinking. But it's like, but say it, my parents would never agree.
And that's the problem.
So they constantly... Right. So the parent needs to come themselves.
They need to educate themselves firstly.
Yeah, and, you know, say to their kids, okay, this is what you're going through. This is the halal way. This is the haram way. This is what has to be done, and so on and so forth.
Right.
Otherwise, we're going to have
because this is a problem. I might say toxic, but at least it is a very sensitive subject. And it is often not spoken about in our communities at all.
Well, I mean, it's not toxic.
Well, not toxic in that manner, but it can spiral in a,
Now, look, there are matters in life where we need to face head to head.
Right.
But it's the approach that makes a difference.
Right.
Okay, so some people approach it differently, like in the wrong manner, and some people approach it correctly. So
it's a volatile subject. There we have it. That's the word.
Yeah, so you need to obviously approach it correctly.
Right, right. And with that said, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th Surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are talking about how to raise our teenagers in an Islamic manner. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us even further.
Now, we also have to keep in mind that when we are dealing with teenagers, that we need to teach them not only about the period they're in, but also prepare them for it. They have to be prepared for what's to come and explain, like I said, things to them. So we need to teach them to think and contemplate and think of consequences. because at this age, they haven't had a prior experience in life.
So this is a general rule, not just about Islamic laws?
No, no, it's just, general rule. I mean, all these general rules that we have, obviously, is derived from Islam.
Right,
so, for example, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, إِذَا هَمَمْتَ بِأَمْرٍ فَتَدَبَّرْ عَقِبَتَهُ.
Right.
If you want to do something, if in kana khayran fa'aqdim,
if it was good, about contemplation.
Do it. If not, don't. Right. So there is, you know, so this is all Islamic teachings basically,
right.
But we're just putting it in simple words. So we need to teach the kid to think and contemplate before he does any action or before they act. Okay, because at this stage, like I said, they themselves do not have prior experience.
Right. No life experience.
So they have no experience at all. They don't know what to do when certain things happen.
Of course.
And now it's me, it's my job, a new job to teach them.
Right.
Make them think for themselves. Yes. Make them more, they use their insight and use their intellect and be able to contemplate on things themselves.
It's basically a rule of life.
Yeah, so it's not, even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for example, when you see in the Quran, when constantly talks about the stories of other nations or the Aqwam before us.
Right.
Well, obviously, he's not trying to entertain me and you with this story.
No.
I mean, some of them
not
are
just
quite
a story time.
Yes, some of them are quite entertaining in their nature, but the idea was that Allah's trying to teach you something that you should learn
from
the people who were before you. What they did and the consequences.
Reflect upon
that
their actions.
And you should not do the same at all.
Right.
Same thing with our kids. So you sit them down. I've seen this happen many times with parents. They bore their kids to death.
Like,
when I was your age, I had this and I done
you
this.
Go
when
on.
I was your age.
To be fair, some stories can be very interesting. But
No, the story is one thing, but if you're using it as a method of trying to teach your child, just by reflecting on your past and that's it. I mean, I've heard many times, like, we've heard this so many times, my dad always said this. He always says, when I was young, I did this. I heard this from my dad all the time. I'm like, when I was at this age, I used to read this bunch book, and then I used to be like, oh, yeah, sure, because you had no TV.
Right.
You had nothing else to do.
It was always,
So that's not the way to get them to think and contemplate and think of their consequences. So we have to train them, basically, into the correct, right method of thinking, the correct and right method of having an insight into things, and the correct method of trying to contemplate on matters. For example, sometimes when I talk to kids, I throw in a line or two, and I leave it unanswerable, and they're like, okay, so I'm like, what do you think?
Right.
So he automatically starts to...
So you engage the thinking.
Yeah. Right. So he has to do the thinking for himself. So this is what we need to do as well.
Right, and with that, we will unfortunately have to end today's program. I thank you for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any comments or questions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. In addition to that, we also have social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.